The story, child care. When Valerie came home from school, crisis procedures took over. As a gentle third grader in a new town, she and we trusted the walk from our house to the school and back. That turned out to be a mistake. She arrived home crying and beaten up from the attack of a gang of kids. A quick investigation caused us to believe that this was a once-only event, so we comforted her and sent her back to school the next day. On the way home, the same thing happened again. That was it. This is my daughter, and they were not going to treat my daughter that way. So for a week, I walked her to school and then walked her back home. I wanted all the neighborhood to see who her daddy was and who they would have to hit several times before they got to her again. Before I left each day, I would look in the mirror and practice looking mean. On the way, I would scowl at everyone we met. I took along the Gail Irwin nonviolent threatening system, my camera. Whenever we met anyone, I would ask her, "Is that one of them?" If she said yes, then I would point my camera and click the shutter. The shock of being recognized would register on their faces. They now knew they could not hide in anonymity. They were on permanent record, like the great memory of God. Yeah, actually, I had no film in the camera. Not necessary. From then on, she walked in peace. They knew her daddy, and they knew her daddy knew them. Enough. Discussion. Describe how you have seen the protective hand of God. When do you pray for his protection? Number 2. How do you think God might be protecting you when you are not aware? Number 3. How do you think God wants us to view his other children? Do you have difficulty doing this? The story, Deidre. Every breath seemed like the last to Deidre's heaving little body. Minutes earlier, she entered the breathing world weeks too early. Doctors quickly assessed the situation, and Deidre's first day of birth began with 6 hours on the operating table as surgeons attempted to close the multiple large holes in her left lung. Finally, they closed her chest. The little form lay too small, the lungs too delicate, the holes too many and too large. The doctors informed her parents that they had been unsuccessful. All they could do was leave a tube in her chest in hopes that they could drain the leaking air fast enough to keep the lung inflated, which to this point had not worked well. These events occupied all of Saturday, and by Sunday morning, doctors' hopes had faded. However, Deidre's parents and friends hoped in a different source for her than her doctors did. At about 11 a.m. on Sunday morning, the people of Deidre's church were praying for her. They knew that any healing could not be argued. Any miracle would only glorify God. At about 11 a.m., the holes suddenly, unexpectedly closed in Deidre's lungs. Though premature, she was now a healthy child. In the following months, as she would go for her checkups, all the personnel of the clinic would gather to observe the miracle child and wonder at the fact that her left lung was stronger than her right one. Discussion. Have you ever seen a miracle of healing? If so, describe it. Number 2. Describe any other sort of miracle you have observed and your reactions to it. Number 3. When did you last join a large number of people to pray for a single thing? What need brought you together in prayer? The story, blackouts. Pascagoula. Yes, where the squirrel went berserk, is a Gulf Coast shipbuilding town, which during World War II made it a prime target and a defense town. German U-boats hovered just off the coast. Camouflaged gun emplacements lined the treed shoreline. Frequent gun target practice would rattle the windows of the whole city. As a 5-year-old, I was both excited and terrified. The top half of all automobile headlights were painted black to keep enemy planes from seeing the lights at night and thus knowing where to drop bombs. I checked the skies frequently. The blackout was the most terrifying of all the precautions. Often at night, loud sirens would sound. Citizens of the city were to go home and turn out all lights in and around their house. The city must be shrouded in darkness to foil enemy attempts to bomb. Now, 5-year-olds don't understand this, but one other item made it almost unbearable. Whenever people sat together in the dark of a blackout, they whispered when they talked. To me, that meant that the enemy was in our yard and we didn't want them to hear us talking. The only relief available would be the next siren signal to turn the lights back on. Ah, light. Discussion. What special fears can you remember from your childhood? 2. What do you consider to be your greatest external threat? 3. What fears do you battle the most now? The story, The Playground. Traveling west out of Urbana into downtown Champaign, Illinois, you pass under a railroad trestle out into a large brick plaza where several streets emerge. Behind my van as I approached the underpass followed a large truck and a car. Beyond the underpass, I noticed a small girl running out into the apparently empty plaza. To her, it looked like the largest playground she had ever seen. I knew that the truck behind me could not see her or avoid her, so I took the only steps available. I slammed on the brakes while under the railroad, effectively blocking the road, jumped out of my van, and ran to retrieve the little girl. The truck and car drivers, who also had to do an emergency stop, were honking and shouting obscenities at me. I ran to the little girl who, when she saw me, began running, terrified, away from me. I picked her up as she screamed and pushed me away. The vehicles had backed up to come around the underpass, and the drivers continued their abuse as they drove by. As I held the screaming baby girl, I knew her mother must be somewhere nearby. Sure enough, a distraught mother rounded the corner of a building, spotted us, and began running toward us. At this point, there were no other vehicles or people around, only me and the screaming baby girl trying to push away from me. The mother rushed up in a huff, grabbed her daughter, and she scowled at me and began to walk off. A few steps away, she stopped, looked back at me as if to say, "You pervert," then stomped on off. Nothing was said by either of us. I stood there for a moment and simply felt the situation. Everyone was mad at me. The vehicle drivers, the little girl, the girl's mother. Yet I had just saved the little girl's life. I walked numbly back to my van where other vehicles were now taking evasive action. Just before I began to seriously feel sorry for myself, the Lord impressed on my heart, "Now you know how I feel most of the time." Discussion. 1. Have you ever had your actions totally misunderstood? How? 2. When have you been upset with God because you thought He might have failed you? 3. How and from what do you tend to most want to rescue people? The story, the CEO. I sank gratefully into my first-class seat, thankful for an upgrade from my frequent flying. Often passengers retreat into their own thoughts, but the chap next to me chose to verbalize his. He was high up in a major corporation and on his way to a troubleshooting task. Soon we talked of life and travel. Now, the discovery of my massive miles and hours and countries brought the expected question, "Just what do you do, mister?" I answered, as I usually do, "I have more fun than anybody. I go all over the world teaching on the nature of Jesus." "Well, I'm not a religious man myself," he shot back. "Really? Then where do you get your values?" "Well, what do you mean? I just have them." "Well, values are given or imposed when we accept some authority. No one automatically has values. Someone must give us values. If you don't believe in God and the Bible, how would I know what you value?" "Well, I guess you wouldn't. I just want to earn enough money to be secure and raise my family right." "But if money is your value system, if I did business with you, you would probably cheat me." There was a pause. "Yes, I guess I would," he said. "So if you aren't a believer in the Bible, you have no trustworthy, predictable value system." "Well, it's all so complicated," he said. "Who's right? It's too complicated for me to figure out." "That's strange," I answered. "I know children who have figured it out." "Okay, okay. But I'm a busy man and things are going good for me. I don't have time for that." "Well, everything has a price. And at some point you won't be busy and things won't be going good. In your system, you're headed for destruction and you have nowhere to turn. How will your money help you if one of your children dies or if you die?" He stared at me silently. I continued, "Look at it this way. Suppose you're right and I'm wrong. I'm not rich, but I'm having so much fun I can hardly stand it. I harm no one. I eat and sleep well. If you're right, tell me what I've lost." "Well, nothing," he said. "But if I am right and you refuse to know and serve God, what have you lost?" His response was quick. "Everything." We had come to the gate and the door of the plane was about to open. Only then did I realize that our conversation was heard all over our first-class cabin and that the people silently listened. I offered him my card and asked him to call me. He took the card and bade me goodbye. A quiet, thoughtful group exited that airplane. Discussion. In your observation, what are the main reasons people give for not being a Christian? Number two, describe some of your own values and relate how you received them. Number three, if you could sit in my place on that plane, what would you like to tell this chief executive officer? The story, trophies. Every person collects trophies. Whether you're conscious or not of your trophies, they line the walls of your heart and maybe your house. I collect trophies too. Nothing that I have won, mind you, but some things I never want to give up. They represent victories in a way far more important than any competitive sport to me. These are trophies of life that come because the kingdom of God is winning. Let me describe a few. The armband. The Hitler of Romania, Ceausescu, had been overthrown for only 4 months when I made my second journey to that country. Accompanied by Damien Kyle, I made my way to the town of Brasov in the center of the country at the foot of the Transylvanian mountains to teach a group of young people and see what the Lord was doing among them. The week was cold and difficult, mostly because I was not over a virus that still caused hoarseness and uncontrollable coughing. But the hearts of the young people were open and responsive. At the end of the week, they marched out some gifts from them to us. Two of them gave specific gifts that continue to be displayed in my home and my heart. During the Romanian Revolution, people gathered en masse in the downtown plazas to protest the government and display their unity. Each person would wear an armband of the colors of the flag to identify himself as a protester. This act subjected them to machine gun fire of the secret police. It was an act of bravery. One of those armbands now graces my home. I see it daily and pray for Romania, a true trophy. The cloth case. India possesses so many stories that I barely listened as a leader told me of a Burmese pastor who, working alone, founded about 20 churches under the most difficult circumstances in Burma, which is now called Myanmar. Times became so hard and persecution so difficult that he despaired about his churches and their pastors. Somehow, and this is not clear in my memory, he heard that an organization in India called Gospel for Asia helped support such pastors. With a minimum of information and no money, he set out on a gigantic journey by foot, bus, and train, making his way by selling cloth side bags that he had made. After a month of journeying, he found his way to the headquarters of Gospel for Asia in Kerala State on the southern tip of India. He knew none of the Malayalam language of Kerala, or even Hindi, or English, the other main languages. When he arrived, he could not communicate who he was or why he came. They considered him to be a beggar common to the area and sent him elsewhere. He came back each day, growing weaker from hunger, when finally they realized that something more was present in this man. By the sign languages instinctively created by people, they learned where he was from, managed to find someone who knew a little of his language, and began the relationship that would result in the support of his pastors. His persistence and bravery was remarkable. The last one of his cloth bags, his personal one, hangs on my wall now, a continuous invitation to prayer for Myanmar and a gentle reminder of the ease of my own life. Suspenders, if you're an American. Braces, if you're British. Hosenträger, if you're a German. I happen to dislike wearing belts. Now please resist the temptation to comment about my body shape. When suspenders came into style, I was delighted and determined to keep them in style. For me, they were the most comfortable way to hold my trousers up hitchlessly. Alas, they have become my trademark, and by gift and design, a rather bright, sometimes wild part of my wardrobe. Some I bought because they were outrageous. Others are just trophies. One pair is rather bland until you look closer and notice that against its grayness are the signatures of about 45 people who expressed their love to me after a week of teaching by wanting me to wear their names. That trophy now hangs on the wall of a Christian coffee house on the island of Maui in Hawaii. The giant pen. The very computer on which this is being written is a trophy. Frankly, I'm a gadgeteer, delighted by the invention of the computer. It surpasses all other tools or machines that I've owned in saving time and doing the difficult. In early days, Servant Quarters, my newsletter, took me 2 weeks to type, copy fit, and paste up. Now, all can be done in one morning. Also, I work best and think best typing rather than handwriting. A chorus of amens rises from all who've seen my handwriting. Therefore, logic says that to enhance my writing as I travel, I need a notebook computer. To my delight, Friends of mine were thinking ahead of that. A group of them got together and from their generous hearts presented to me the Macintosh PowerBook that I'm typing on at this moment at 32,000 feet over New Mexico. Now, am I blessed or am I blessed? This is a trophy that displays itself to me almost every day. The stock certificates. My grandfather, a very astute farmer whom God always prospered, which is a story in itself that I must tell you someday, at one point owned some stock in a major automobile manufacturer in the infancy of the automobile. Because he didn't think the automobile, as he observed it, was going to make it, he sold the stock. Ah, mistake. My father learned from the mistake of his father, so when the Tucker automobile came out, my father sank his life savings into that company. You don't know what a Tucker is? Yeah, that's the problem. The stock certificate was passed along to me for the fun of it, since I was with my father in that crowd on the day that the Tucker was introduced to the world. It is an interesting trophy. Add to that a model Tucker automobile given to me by Earl Pitts of Canada. At least it reminds me that this world is not my home. The pot. Zimbabwe, formerly Rhodesia, has been a favorite country of mine for many years. Many events associated with my visits warm my heart regularly. Once when Ada and I visited, people wanted us to visit their houses and walk into every room, then pray for them. They believed that blessing would flow to every room we were in. I was amused, but deeply moved. At the home of a black lady who was the best translator I have ever had, she could translate into Shona simultaneously while I was speaking, she came with a pot in her hands, running up to our car as we were about to leave. She handed the pot to us, explaining that this had been in her family for many years, having been made by her grandmother. She wanted to give it to us. You'll see that trophy when you visit us, but don't miss what's inside. Oh, it's nothing dramatic, just an old, ragged, white towel. The towel, too, is a gift. I found black Zimbabweans to be very generous with us, though they had virtually nothing. They averaged about $35 a month in income. After speaking at churches or conferences, they would take up offerings for us, mostly composed of small coins with an occasional $2 bill. They gave generously out of their nothingness. Often they would have no money at all, but moved by their own hearts would give whatever they had. Well, money cannot be taken out of Zimbabwe, so we spent or gave away whatever we received while there. However, ragged white towels, given as widow's mite, can be brought home. A trophy that only we can understand. The bronze head. In 1978, I made my first trip to Southern Africa to what was then Rhodesia. I had been invited to speak at a national renewal conference, only the second conference of any sort in the country to which all races had been invited. I was honored and gladly paid the cost from a poverty college teaching salary to get there. They chose to give me a very heavy teaching load, including several hours on Christian family subjects that resulted in more hours being spent talking to individuals in smaller groups. It seemed that the nation had never had a chance to explore the subject or face a counselor. One such person whose life began to come together during the conference happened to be an accomplished professional artist. She indicated that she wanted to give me a gift, but I routinely discouraged it. Finally, she insisted that I come to where her car was parked and decide if I wanted to receive the gift. There, wrapped in cloth in the seat, was a museum-quality, life-size bronze sculpting of the head of a Shona tribesman. Nothing could have been more appropriate for me. I had come to deeply love the people of the country. No symbol could have been better. If you visit me, you'll find this sculpture prominently displayed. I see it, and I think of Zimbabwe and pray for its people. On subsequent trips, I met people who used the tapes of those sessions as church during the difficult days of their civil war when travel was severely restricted. I think of those people and cherish the trophy. The photos. A special drawer holds photographs. Some are the children of dear friends. Other pictures are from people who have adopted me as their grandfather or dad. One is even a snap-snap shot. Private joke here. Some, or most, are pictures of me in various indignities while I'm speaking. I could never run for president with those photos running around. Many are pictures of people who've chosen to pray for me. Some are from people who want me to pray for them. Potpourri. So many other trophies adorn our house and office that it's impossible to tell each story. They range from suspenders especially made for me, aloha, pottery especially made for us, Gale dolls, Gale dolls, paintings, caricatures, and other forms of art, letters, Calvary Chapel, memorabilia, tapes, CDs, food adorns something else, by the way, such as chocolate-covered raisins, jalapeno peppers, and salsa. Life is such a gift of gifts. I wonder if anywhere in the world has such a collection of trophies from people who love you and who let you know exists. I doubt it. Maybe I should open a museum of the heart. Discussion. Describe the trophies or special mementos that you have. 2. Which ones did you earn, and how and which ones were gifts, and why? 3. If you could give someone a special trophy, to whom would it go, and what would it be? The story, Galena and Zenaida. The unusually large crowd at the Jordan River site, where Christian pilgrims often are baptized to commemorate the baptism of Jesus, gathered and stared over the railing as several pastors immersed their parishioners. I knew these were mostly Romanians who had come to work in Israel, as well as some scattered other Eastern European workers. I was glad they were watching. They were very quiet and respectful when we were having the service. In fact, the only people who disturbed our time were Western tourists who insisted on getting in the middle of things to have their picture taken without regard to what was happening. I baptized, at the end of the progression, those people who wanted to be immersed and whose pastor was not along on the trip. I considered the opportunity a joy and privilege. The water, not as cold as I remembered in prior winters, seemed to increase the number being baptized. Just as I finished my statement and lowered the last person into the symbolic death, I looked up and saw two more people coming into line, dressed in white robes. I did not recognize either of them. They approached me as if they knew exactly what they were doing and stood ready to be baptized. I was surprised, but glad to serve them. When asked, the first lady blurted out her name. Galina from Russia, she proudly declared. I announced her name and country to the crowd, and they applauded vigorously. After baptizing her, the next lady waded closer, and I asked her name. Zenaida from Bratislava, came her reply. My own heart was thrilled that I could be present at this great moment for these ladies. They waded back out of the water, and I followed. Zenaida stopped at the edge of the river, leaned against the wall, and wept. I waited near her to share her great moment. The baptismal session was over. They disappeared back into the crowd. I may never meet them again, but I was glad I was there. And I was glad that they were there. Discussion. When and where were you baptized? 2. What meaning did baptism have to you? What other spiritual experiences have meaning for you? 3. How would you feel about being baptized in a strange place surrounded by a crowd of unbelievers and tourists? The story? Venice. Most people think that the Mississippi River ends at New Orleans. They're surprised to discover that another 100 miles stretches and then meanders to the Gulf of Mexico. The isolated, little-known delta land served varied and often questionable purposes in its past. Not until the 1940s did the engineers build a road toward the mouth. Until then, only boats could take you to this area. For that reason, many who wanted to disappear from the world, escapees, malcontents, hermits, found a life that pleased and protected them far away from governmental eyes. The census could only guess at the number of people living in the marshland and among the bayous. Business was cash only in this area. In most parts of the parish, as Louisiana calls its counties, addresses didn't even exist. One simply hunted until he found the house he was looking for. My arrival there to serve my first pastorate is still a source of wonder. My wife and I thought we were going to East Tennessee to serve a church there, but though the call from that church was made in the form of a letter, we did not receive it. So we found our way to this remote spot. The church had been without a pastor for 9 months. Their mortgage payments were behind to an embarrassment. Places to live were scarce and very low quality. Work was plentiful, which was good for me since the church was unable to help a pastor in any way. The whole area sat on a pool of oil, so much of the work revolved around the oil industry, with fishing taking the remainder. Actually, most oil workers involved themselves with fishing also. First Sunday Eye Opener. The area operated as if it were a colony of old apartheid South Africa. 3 separate school systems existed for whites, blacks, and mulattoes, those who were a mixture. How your birth certificate described your race had total control over your life. Evidence of the overwhelming racism captured our first 2 Sundays there. Church service ended near noon, and an hour later I received a call from one of the 2 deacons in the congregation. They had been involved in an accident near his home and asked me to come and see to his affairs while he took his family to the hospital. I was not prepared for what I was about to experience. The deacon had been hit by the car of a black man as he was pushing to get it started on a narrow blind lane. I arrived shortly before the sheriff's deputy. Now, there were no incorporated towns in the parish, so the sheriff's department handled all policing details. The first words out of the mouth of the deputy, and forgive my use of these, I'm only reporting, were, "Nigger, you got any insurance?" "Nossa." "You know they can put you under the jail for this, don't you?"
"Yassa."
"Now, it won't help you for this accident, but if they know you have some, they might go easy on you, and I can sell it to you now."
"Yassa."
The deputy whipped out an application pad, filled it out, collected his money, and then said, "Okay, now tell me what happened here." I sat there quietly wondering what kind of place God had sent me to and what my role would be. I didn't know that the next Sunday would provide even more evidence. Once again, service had ended and all the folks were gone. As I prepared to lock the doors, I looked up the highway and noticed a number of cars gathered, precariously parked along the elevated road. Wanting to explore anything exciting in our new area, my wife and I jumped into our car and drove up there. As we slowly drove by, we asked the people standing around what was going on. No one would tell us, or even say anything to us, for that matter. The parish had no newspapers, so we knew this would not be a news item. We returned to our house frustrated. However, our landlady served as the area human newspaper, and she filled us in on all the details. A black man had caught his brother with his wife and shot and killed him. He was arrested and taken away, simple as that. 3 years later, it occurred to me to ask our landlady what had happened to the man who had killed his brother. She informed me he was still working for the administration at the county or parish seat, and as long as he worked for them, they promised they wouldn't hang him. Slavery still existed. The county was governed, no, ruled, by a man who had no official position in the county government. He was merely chairman of the advisory council to the elected officials. He so totally dictated that even PTA committees in schools would not offer any reports until they had checked with the administration, as they called him. Passing failure. After working for an oil company for 2 years in order to be able to pastor there, since the church paid no salary, I finally landed my original goal, a job as a school teacher. A few weeks after my work began as a school teacher, I received a phone call from a neighbor, a party hack for the administration. "You're being paid by the administration now, and I see you're not registered to vote. You need to register so you can help the administration out when they need you." "Well," I responded, "I haven't registered because I didn't want to get involved in politics here. I only wanted to help people in spiritual ways." "Well, I don't care why you came here. You have to register because we're paying your salary." My salary, by the way, was $3,000 a year. "I can't register," I said. "The office is open only during the week, and I have to teach at that time." "Well, they'll be open this Saturday. You be there." So Ada and I drove up the river road and took the ferry across to the parish seat. Nothing was open except the office to register to vote. The official waited, feet on his desk, for us to arrive. He handed each of us a test on the Constitution, which we had to pass before we could register. Suddenly I had a brilliant idea. Since I had extensively debated this constitutional subject while in high school, I knew which answers were wrong. I purposely failed the test. I nearly laughed when the official informed me that I had passed. Then he asked with which party we wanted to register. Well, I told him that I was neither a Democrat or a Republican. Could I register as an independent? He stared at us for a minute and said, "I guess you can if you want to." Well, we did. We returned home feeling a small sense of victory that we could register as independents. That sense was short-lived. On Monday morning, the phone rang early. It was the party hack. He screamed at me, "You registered as an independent! Why did you do that? You know you can't help the administration that way. There aren't any independents down here. You're in trouble." I reported all this to the school principal where I now taught. He told me not to worry. He'd protect me. However, from that time until we left for another pastorate, we received regular death threats by phone. Black gold. Who owned the land in this parish was a question that floated somewhere up there in airy fairyland. This confusion served the greedy very well. Fraudulent land seekers would claim land and offer to lease it to the oil companies as theirs. The oil companies, prisoners to the system in place, would pay. The manager of an oil field supply company told me that when the company decided to open a shop there, he found a vacant place, taped a notice to the door saying he would be present on a certain day to deal on a contract. When the day came, 5 people showed up with titles to the property. The supply company manager told me that we looked them over, decided which one looked best to us, and have been paying rent to that person ever since. The oysters in those coastal waters were the largest and best I have ever tasted. Local oyster fishermen would claim oyster leases from the parish government. By law, these 1 or 2 acre plots of water were to be basically square. But most of them seemed to be 1 foot wide and about 50 miles long. Here's why. Whenever an oil company needed to run a pipeline from its wells to the storage area, they had to pay for any damage done as they went through an area, as well as leasing the land. If an oil company passed through an oyster lease, they had to pay the fisherman for any loss of oysters in his lease. Now imagine a series of parallel 1 foot wide oyster leases running up and down the coastline. To run a pipeline, you must cross each one of them. One company official complained to me that he bought an entire crop for each lease that he crossed. It was the only time I ever observed someone getting the best of an oil company. Having been gouged by artificial gasoline prices, I feel justified in applauding these wily Cajuns. Just in case you may have forgotten, Cajun is an adulteration of the word Acadian, who were French refugees from the British takeover of Canada. Longfellow made the story famous in his poem, Evangeline. Mosquitoes, snakes, and fish. Our first few weeks at the church were difficult because I had not found a job and we needed to stay alive. The abundance of the area sustained us. I could walk in almost any direction for 200 yards and fish as much as I wanted. No, I should say catch as much as I wanted. The place was awesome. Plus, we had commercial fishermen in the church who would supply us with fish they could not sell. We ate gourmet. Yes, I have a fish story, and it isn't anything like you think. But first, let me tell you about the mosquitoes. One almost needed a shotgun to handle them. They were large and they were plentiful. They ruled everyone's lives. You could not walk through tall grass or stand still in a slight breeze or sit placidly in the cool of the evening outside your house. These blood-sucking machines owned the outside and redefined the word miserable. As you walked, they clung to your clothing and your skin. Slapping each one was like trying to eradicate roaches with a Mexican hat dance. If you were foolhardy enough to just walk along, you needed a grass or horsetail whip to constantly slap your body, just as horses do. This mosquito problem deeply affected church and hospitality. Whenever people came to church, they did not simply walk in the door. They would quickly enter in clumps, then stand inside the door and wait while an usher would spray them down with a pump spray can of insecticide. What a greeting. We had to kill all mosquitoes or they would drive you crazy while you sat inside during the service. The same ritual would happen if people visited you at your house. People came in quickly when you opened the door and then waited while you sprayed them. The last ritual of any night at our house involved the mosquito. After sucking your blood, they tended to fly to the walls and rest. I rolled up a magazine each evening and walked through the house on a mosquito hunt, slapping them against the wall. Our house was covered with blood spots as if we regularly had violent fights. Once, somehow, a horde of mosquitoes invaded the house. The ceiling was black with them. My wife took the vacuum cleaner and went row by row and vacuumed them away. Our daughter Angela was extremely allergic to their bites and would scream and claw herself, especially at night when they bit. We had to seek a medical specialist for treatment of her raw skin. But let's go from mosquitoes to snakes. All 4 species of poisonous snakes abounded in that area. The last few miles of highway before the end of the road split through a large marsh were always covered, even in the winter, with migrating snakes. But in the spring, snake carcasses paved the road from cars running over them. In spite of that abundance of snakes, I never heard of any worker being bitten as he worked in the wetlands among them. What an interesting place. Ultimate snake story. Now that we're on snakes, let me tell you the fish story. I warn that you may hesitate to believe what I'm about to tell, but the story is true. Sherwood Brine can verify it. He was with me, or I was with him, and he saw and participated in every bit of the incident. We were fishing with gill nets in the back canals of an oil company at the very end of the road. At certain points, small hills rose beside the canals where dredges dumped the refuse as they dug the canals. We picked a corner of a canal by one such hill and slowly released the net into the water. We would then beat the side of the boat to drive fish toward the net. We had only begun to beat the boat when we looked up and saw hundreds of cottonmouth water moccasin snakes writhing in what appeared to be a mating dance. Most were on the shore and up the small hill, but many moved about with their heads sticking out high above the water in this dance movement. We had large oars and decided to clip off a few heads with them. But as we rode among the snakes, we realized that we were on their turf and quickly cranked up the outboard and got out of there. Now, I frequently watch nature films and see many strange things in them, but I had never seen any such thing in any nature presentation until just recently, some 30 years later. A naturalist crawled into a rattlesnake den and filmed them in just such a dance. Although to my surprise, I learned it was not a mating dance at all, but bull moccasin snakes fighting over who would get to mate with the females. Amazing. Every man has a fish story. Indulge me, please, for one more fish story. I loved going to the mouth of one Mississippi River pass where the water became shallow over mud flats and fish there for flounder. Well, not exactly fish, but gig them, a broom handle with a sharp spike on the end. So you had to have at least two people. Three was better. One would hold a bright lantern while the other walked along carrying the gig looking for the outline of a nesting flounder in the sand. You would then jab the gig into the fish, hold it down while it threw water and sand all over you. A 5-pounder could nearly drown you, by the way. Then you would slip your hand under the fish, holding it to the base of the gig and lift it into the game bag hanging at your side. All well and good, except for one bit of excitement. Stingrays, which have a similar shape to the flounder, also nested where the flounder were. And if you stepped on one of them, your trip ended. Occasionally, we would step on a nesting flounder whose camouflage escaped our attention. For an agonizing moment as the earth quaked under your feet, you waited to see if a sharp pain signaled your worst fears. You would think that the ray's tail of the stingray would give him away, but the reeds growing in the water looked amazingly all like stingray tails. Well, we never stepped on a stingray, since the way around that was not to actually walk, but to shuffle your feet along. This would drive away any fish that you didn't actually see, including stingrays. Moving up. We left Venice at the invitation of the state denominational leader to come and serve the church that he attended in the center of the state. The Venice church had grown enough that the new pastor who came did not need an outside job to serve as pastor. I was very happy about that. However, two successive events turned my happiness into grief. A year or so after we left, a hurricane ripped through that area, destroying almost everything in its path. The church building where I served was demolished. The parsonage we had built was moved a quarter of a mile away from its foundation. The parsonage was moved back later and placed on a new foundation. The church was rebuilt, this time with brick. Not long after that, another more vicious hurricane ground the area to mud. Neither the brick church nor the parsonage were ever found. The baptistry was found a half mile away. I visited the site and realized that the only thing left of my sojourn in Venice was memories. Discussion. being as, well, as honest as you can, what racial injustices have you observed? 2. What tragedies have hit you or your family, and how did they affect you? 3. Because of changes or demolition, what places in your past are only memories to you? What kind of memories are they? The story, Baked Beans and Beer. Leonard, a true cowboy, worked on a West Texas ranch. He was only 20 at the time and had recently made a commitment to Jesus Christ. However, it was not too deep or too intense a spiritual life that he led. Now he sat on a railroad tie laid near the chuck wagon, exhausted from the morning's work of herding 600 head of cattle. He spooned his baked beans and drank tea from a peach can. A photographer happened to be on the ranch that day, and he asked Leonard if he minded having his picture taken. "Well, it's okay with me as long as you don't keep me from eating my beans," he answered. For 3 days, the photographer trailed the cowboy crew, snapping pictures along the way. A few months later, Leonard received a form to sign releasing the photographer to use the photos and offering him $250. Well, struggling to pay debts, including medical bills that piled up for his wife and newborn son, Leonard thought $250 would make a hospital payment. He quickly signed and mailed a release. 3 years passed, and the photographer session was forgotten. In the meantime, during the visit of a famous evangelist, Leonard fully committed himself to the Lord. Then one day, a fellow worker told him that his picture was in bars all over town under the title Baked Beans and Beer. He then discovered that the photographer had been commissioned by a major company to paint a series of cowboy pictures. In using Leonard, he had replaced the peach can of tea with a can of beer. The picture was plastered all over the United States. Leonard was crushed. He felt that his new life in Christ was ruined, that he would now become a detriment to the kingdom, and his witness would be destroyed. He spent considerable time explaining to people that he didn't know that his photos would be used this way. Turn it over to me. Shortly afterward, at the closing invitation of the large Baptist church that he attended, he began to sob uncontrollably. God whispered to him, "Are you willing to turn that picture over to me? If so, respond to this invitation." He lurched to the front, continuing to weep intensely. He felt that he owed an explanation to the pastor, so he went to him and told him what was happening. The pastor asked him to tell the whole church that night, and between sobs the story spilled out. What he did not know until years later was that his story dramatically changed the lives of many people there. They realized the value of their lives and names and the vulnerability of their commitment. People everywhere began to recognize him and ask if he was the cowboy in the painting. This opened opportunities to tell about his new life in Christ. Many came to know the Lord. God was doing a good job with the picture under his care. His new relationship with the Lord took him to the Calvary Chapel Bible School at Twin Peaks, California, and then on to a seminary degree from Southwestern in Fort Worth. After seminary, he and Jan, his wife, and their two sons, Justin and Tell, moved to Nebraska to pioneer a Baptist church. He hoped that no one would know him and that the painting would not be a detriment. His anonymity lasted only a few hours. Every bar in town had his picture on its wall. Soon a reporter came from Omaha and did a story on him that hit the front page of a major Omaha newspaper under the title, slightly erroneously at least, since he had only briefly carried a pistol to protect himself from marijuana growers in the outer ranges. The title was "Cowboy Trades Pistol for Pulpit." Crowds came to church to hear and see this remarkable story. Conversions were the order of the day. One very old couple drove from Iowa just to hear him speak. Then, at his questioning revealed that they were not Christians, but wanted to be. They became. Because of what was happening, his home church began massive assistance to help them build a church. After 18 months, they had a building paid for and full of people. But his heart was in Midland, Texas, and they soon left to go back home and plant a church. However, his plans were intercepted by an invitation to return to Twin Peaks Bible College, this time as a teacher. After a stint there, the pull of Midland grew too strong, and he returned to begin what is now Country Chapel. The very people he would most want to reach already know him. They see his picture every time they visit a bar in the city, and they wonder. Some find out. But Leonard's not the only one in his family with a story of the grace of God. Jan has a story, too. So here is Jan's story. Jan's mother committed suicide when she, Jan, was 18 years old. The date of that death, March 20, haunted her for years. She hated spring because March 20 was coming. This day became the opposite of a holiday, a day of depression and pain, and the loss revisited her annually, refusing to let her cope with the grief. You must abort. Marriage helped, but did not heal the hurt. Soon a child was on the way in their house. However, her body reacted so violently to the pregnancy that she had to seek medical help for that sickness alone. Her doctor declared that this sickness was psychological, that her body was trying to reject the fetus, and that she should have an abortion. Unsatisfied with this diagnosis, they went to another doctor who also declared the condition to be psychological and urged her to get an abortion. A third and a fourth doctor gave identical advice. In their discouragement, they began to actually consider that option, painful as it was to them. Her violent sickness continued, reducing her hunger and adding to her malnutrition. They decided to try one more doctor. He examined her more closely and discovered a vitamin B deficiency and gave her a shot. As they left, she told her husband that she was ravenously hungry. They promptly went for a steak. Her sickness was over. When the baby was delivered, the doctor handed Justin to Leonard and said, "This is the baby that four doctors told you to abort." Ah, but I'm ahead of myself in this story. God had designed this moment for a multiple victory. You see, Justin was due in early February. When the day arrived, no indications of birth were forthcoming. Since everything was healthy otherwise, the doctor said, "Let's just wait." Days and weeks rolled by. Jan fretted that this baby was getting too close to March 20. The last thing she wanted was for the baby to be born on such a day of pain, the day of her mother's suicide. Her distress increased until, sure enough, a remarkable six-week-late baby was born to them on March 20. She complained to God and others that this would happen until she realized that her mourning had now been turned into joy by her newborn. Gone was the pain and grief. God had used this baby Justin as a double victory. Awesome. Just about the time you think you've heard it all, God's grace shows itself again, and I return to the realization that I'm a walking mass of ignorance, gleefully awaiting his next show of power, the kind of power shown in Leonard and Jan Cotton. Discussion. Describe any experience in which God took what you thought was a mistake and used it for good. 2. Describe a time when you stood up for what was right, though everyone seemed against you. 3. Describe any symbols that God has given you to signal that past hurts are healed.
If you are interested in other books and resources by Gail Irwin, We recommend the Jesus Style, the Hallmark book that has gone around the world, the Spirit Style, which gives you the nature of the Holy Spirit, two story books. That reminds me of a story. That reminds me of another story. That those two books together total 100 true stories by Gail Irwin that are from his observation and his experience that are so unique that if you don't hear them from him, you never hear them. And one other book, not on audio or CD, and that's Handbook for Servants, which is his newest one that deals with some of the nagging questions for those who serve. You can write us at Servant Quarters, Box 219, Cathedral City, California, 92235, or call us toll-free, 1-888-321-0077. Access our website at www.servant.org or email us at gayle@servant.org.